In our series, America Since the Bomb, we are now broadcasting The Birth of Pop, an illustrated survey by Ralph J. Gleason.
There is one way of looking at American popular music in 1966, which sees it as the perfect example of the American cultural melting pot. For the first time, America's popular music is a music that draws upon jazz, upon blues, upon folk music, and upon country and western music without inhibition. All these things are wrapped up today into one homogeneous musical sound unlike any that has ever appeared before in America. The roots go back to World War II and the Korean War, when the groundwork was laid for the great breakthrough of Negro and country and western music directly into the broad stream of American popular music, the green and white Niles of music combining into a single present-day Blue River of song. The dominant record companies, RCA Victor, Columbia, and Decca, which controlled the market for the 78 RPM discs, used shellac in manufacturing their records. As soon as the Japanese occupied the Malayan Peninsula and the Philippines, shellac went into acute shortage in the United States. General Yamashita had an unexpected effect on Tin Pan Alley, more than many a songwriter. When it became necessary to budget shellac, and therefore to budget what music was issued, the record companies concentrated on what they thought was the largest, safest market, i.e., the ordinary, middle-class, white, popular, and the classical market. They abandoned the specialty markets of country and western and Negro blues almost entirely, and thereby created an opportunity for small record companies to spring up all over the United States, catering to these markets. A potential manufacturer able to obtain a small quantity of shellac, or some adequate substitute, could make a record and sell it in a specialty field without competition from the major record companies, and he could make money at it. As the economist Paul Baran has pointed out, ease of access became then, and still is, a characteristic of the phonograph record industry. The new music is called rock and roll, and it may be difficult for those over 30, whom Colin McInnes in Absolute Beginners has called the adult types, to accept it. But the truth is that rock and roll has been, for the past 10 years, the dominant American music. Elvis Presley has already celebrated his 10th anniversary as a disc star, thus making come true the New Yorker cartoon, Was It Apocryphal?, which showed a married couple in a suburban home sometime in the future listening to Hound Dog, and one saying to the other, "They're playing our song." Rock and roll's acceptance is dictated by history, not only by the imprimatur of the Ed Sullivan TV show, which validates the success of American entertainment, but by the obvious endorsement of intellectuals, teenagers, and just plain folks. "Don't Knock the Rock" served as a useful slogan, but it was really unnecessary. Rock is here to stay, and it's too big to be denied. Dancing may have been a factor in its emergence. A nation must dance, and after World War II, Americans had ceased to dance. The swing era of the 30s was a dancing era in which the basic dance step, which functioned usefully for the music of the hotel dance band, termed a Mickey Mouse band disdainfully by musicians, or the jazz swing band of Count Basie, was the foxtrot. This standard step was designed for music played in 2-4 and 4-4 common time, and as swing-era bands progressed from the rather primitive sounds of early Fletcher Henderson and late King Oliver on through the more sophisticated sounds of Count Basie and the bands of the 40s, the dance steps also evolved. What came out of it was the dance steps of Harlem, the Lindy Hop and others, which combined foxtrot and ballroom dancing and added acrobatics. The result challenged the capabilities of the ordinary dancer. Everyone danced in the 30s, to Benny Goodman, Glenn Miller, Count Basie, but when the American involvement in Hitler's war strangled the big bands by inflation, dancing ground to a halt. In the early 40s, there were dozens of big bands playing a great circuit of dance halls and ballrooms from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 12 months a year. 10 years later, there were barely half a dozen, and these were mainly listening bands. Thus entered the era of the ballad singers and the vocal groups. Traditionally, students of American popular music have thought in terms of 7-year cycles, the foxtrot, the samba, the charleston, the bunny hug. After World War II came the quick cycle of ballad singers, a quicker cycle of Latin music, the mambo, the calypso, but they didn't last, though each of them, in dying out, left its touch upon the music. By 1954, it was obvious something new was evolving. Record sales were the first indication, and in the classic pattern of the laissez-faire economic system, if something made money, it was to be encouraged. Atlantic Records, then a small company in New York, began to record blues for the Negro market. Sales reports indicated that some of this music, which was designed to sell to Negroes, was being bought in the South by whites as well. They called the music cat music, and they danced to it because it had a heavy beat. Whether the term cat music was a publicist's invention or had some functional reality is lost in the mists of history. However, Atlantic immediately started a new label called Cat Records to take advantage of the trend. Their very first release, and the only one which made any impression, the label itself was quickly devoured by its parent in a classic fashion, was by a vocal group called The Chords. The song was Shaboom, which became a smash hit and brought this Negro music out into the open.
Life could be a dream, life could be a dream. Do, 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 shaboom.
Life could be a dream,
shaboom.
If I could take you up in paradise up above.
Shaboom.
If you would tell me I'm the only one that you love.
Life could be a dream, sweetheart, hello, hello again. Shaboom, and open, we'll meet again, boom.
Ding dong, ding dong, shalang, lang, lang. Oh, 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 pip, a pip, a dope, a dip. Oh,
life could be a dream.
If only all my precious plans would come true. If you would let me spend my whole life loving you. Life could be a dream, sweetheart.
Every time I look at you, something is all my mind. If you do what I want you to, maybe we'd be so fine.
Oh, life could be a dream. Shaboom, if I could take you up in paradise up above. Shaboom, then tell me, darling, I'm the only one that you love. Life could be a dream. Sweetheart, hello, hello again. Shaboom, and hope we'll meet again. Boom, boom, boom.
The classic American pattern in music, from Al Jolson to Bobby Darin, has been for whites to imitate Negroes. As this music became more commercially successful, singers such as Georgia Gibbs, who had been featured vocalist on a very famous weekly radio program during the 40s called The Hit Parade, made a new career for herself as a recording artist by doing cover versions of hits by Negro singers. Pat Boone and others followed suit, and performances by Negro vocal groups and solo singers were done over in white versions for the general market. Bill Haley and his Comets, featuring the electric guitars long used by country and western artists and taken up by city blues players in the late 40s, made a hit of a record originally done by Joe Turner for Atlantic. Turner was well known as a blues singer from the 30s and 40s, and his disc of Shake, Rattle, and Roll was quite popular with the blues audience. Haley recorded it, and it became a tremendous national hit in 1954. In less than 18 months, Haley had another hit. This time, it was Rock Around the Clock, which was featured in the film Blackboard Jungle, and it became one of the biggest commercial successes of the 50s.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me, hon. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. When the clock strikes 2, 3, and 4, if the band slows down, we'll yell for more. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. When the chimes ring 5, 6, and 7, we'll be right in seventh heaven. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Oh, when it's 8, 9, 10, 11, 2, I'll be going strong, and so will you. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight.
An interesting example of unsuspected tradition in popular music is that Rock Around the Clock bore a startling resemblance to My Baby Rocks Me with One Steady Roll, a jazz classic recorded in the late 1920s featuring clarinetist Jimmy Noon and pianist Earl Hines. Within a few months, rock and roll, as it began to be called, became truly big business, and its struggle with the adult musical establishment began to take shape. Variety, the show business weekly, led a crusade against dirty lyrics, which culminated in a songwriter pointing out that the classic pattern always had been the juxtaposition of male and female sans detail. In a letter to Variety, songwriter Al Stillman pointed out, "There's a small hotel, a hit song of the 30s, never clarified the marital status of the couple it discussed." A congressional committee investigated gangland influence in jukeboxes and hit records, only to prove that even with the Chicago mob's control of jukeboxes, it couldn't make a hit for a singer. Hearings were held in Washington on the supposed influence of Broadcast Music Incorporated, the organization of composers and publishers of music formed in the late 30s to compete with the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, in forcing this new music upon the public. Mitch Miller, the recording director who produced Frankie Lane's Mule Train, complained of radio surrendering to the bubblegum set. Basically, it was all an argument about money. BMI was oriented towards the composer-performer and towards the one-shot hit. ASCAP, because of its structure, was a representative of the traditional Tin Pan Alley Broadway musical professional songwriter. The new performer-writers tended to affiliate with BMI because there they could get performance royalties more quickly. TV changed radio in America from a general entertainment medium into a medium that depended basically on the low-budget recorded music and news. This occurred exactly at the time that the cheap phonograph, transistorized and mass-produced, came on the market and put a turntable in every American home. It also coincided with the advent of the cheap portable radio, which put an earplug into every teenager's skull. Thus, at the end of World War II, a handful of record companies dominated the market, and a covey, or perhaps one should say a groove, of smaller companies was springing up all over the U.S., issuing specialty music for specialty audiences and licensing that music and collecting royalties from airplay on it through Broadcast Music Incorporated. Given this, and given the rise of radio as an advertising medium for music, the audience, the apparatus, and the performers were all in a position to get this music out to the American public for the first time without it being categorized as minority music. In 1943 in New York, there were only scattered programs of Negro blues and gospel music. Most radio stations broadcast the ballad singers, such as Frank Sinatra and Broadway show music. In the period after World War II, first radio programs and then entire stations catering to the Negro audience came into existence in the United States. Stations catering to country and Western fans emerged even in major metropolitan areas such as New York and Los Angeles. Others were devoted entirely to Negro music. Thus, for the first time in American history, a generation had an opportunity to hear all the varieties of music produced in America, played freely over the radio, and available to all ears. Back in the 30s, a Memphis Slim, a Leadbelly, or a Big Bill Brunzi recorded race records for the Negro market, which were not even sold in the ordinary record stores or played on the air. By the end of the 40s, Big J. McNeely, Eddie Cleanhead Vinson, Jimmy McCracklin, and other blues singers made records aimed at the Negro market, but which were available to the ears of the white audience for the first time because they were played on radio stations in the metropolitan areas. Collections of star performers were put on the road touring the big cities giving musical variety shows. First, it was Jazz at the Philharmonic, Norman Granz's pioneering production. Then it was a series of shows featuring performers popular with the younger audience. Paul Anka, Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, performers whose records had pre-sold a youthful audience for them. A New York disc jockey named Alan Freed, who has since died, presented many of these artists in shows in motion picture theaters in Manhattan and Brooklyn, and coined the phrase rock and roll to characterize the music, adapting it from the lyrics of a blues song. Rock and roll's big breakthrough came at the moment the wars were over and the great changes begun were firmly settled into place. Bing Crosby, the popular singer, had abandoned his coast-to-coast radio network show, and major companies were beginning to discover they could sell music by original artists as well as the cover versions by Georgia Gibbs. Ed Sullivan, who had the most popular television show and is still one of the leaders in American TV, had made a reputation in the 30s and 40s as being interested in minority group music. He had presented many Negro performers at benefit shows in New York when he was a columnist for the Daily News, and he carried this interest in popular entertainment onto his television show. He presented a number of rock and roll stars and discovered that the Negro entertainers could also be presented on TV occasionally. That's the way in which artists such as Fats Domino came to the attention of adult America. Elvis Presley, from Tupelo, Mississippi, scene of a Civil War cavalry battle involving General Nathan Bedford Forrest's troops, recorded several songs in a Nashville garage. RCA Victor bought them from the original company and got back into the popular record business from which it had been preempted by the emerging rock and roll. Presley was openly imitative of the Negro performers and had assimilated the blues. His first hit, Hound Dog, had previously been a hit in the Negro market, sung by Big Mama Willie Mae Thornton. Presley's Heartbreak Hotel combined a blues sound with a country and western sound, and the breakthrough was underway.
Well, since my baby left, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that Heartbreak Hotel where I'll be just so lonely, baby. Well, I'm so lonely, I'll be just so lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted mothers to cry there in the gloom. Be so, well, be so lonely, baby. Well, be so lonely, be so lonely, they could die. Man, the bellhop's tears keep flowing, the desk clerk's dressed in black. Well, they've been so long on the lonely street, they'll never, never look back and think of so. You're so lonely, baby. Well, they're so lonely. Well, they're so lonely, they could die. Well, if your baby leaves you, you got a tale to tell. Well, just take a walk down Lonely Street to Heartbreak Hotel, where you will be. You're so lonely, baby. Well, you'll be lonely. You'll be so lonely, you could die.
'54-'55 was also the end of the McCarthy era, and the American society began to open up again. Comic Stan Freberg made a satirical disc, Point of Order, which was a hit. But adult America could not accept the new music. It could only explain its popularity as part of a conspiracy theory. It had to be true, they reasoned, that something else called good music had been subverted, censored, and kept from the youth, because the music which they, the adults, thought was so bad could only be that popular if manipulation for profit was present. Thus, the argument about money and who controlled the music business and the royalties therefrom, which was the basis for the quarrel between ASCAP and BMI, quickly became a moral problem. Dirty lyrics, payola, and the rest. But the truth, as a man who has spent generations in the business says, is that the hit is in the grooves. You can't buy a hit with payola. And America, so large and with 10,000 radio stations and so many hundreds of thousands of record buyers, is simply not Espresso Bongo. The market is much too diversified. 1954-55 was fascinating. The Ballad of Davy Crockett was a mammoth hit, bringing in its wake a whole wardrobe of Davy Crockett hats and jackets, all because of a watered-down Western-style song written in a hurry by a studio musician recording the soundtrack for a Walt Disney film. Then Maybelline, Chuck Berry's big hit, appeared, giving the new generation of teenagers a frame of reference for years.
Why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started doing the things you used to do. As I was motivating over the hill, I saw Maybelline in a coupe de ville. A Cadillac rolling on an open road, nothing outrun my V8 4. A Cadillac doing about 95, bumper to bumper rolling side to side. Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started back doing the things you used to do. A Cadillac pulled up to 104. My phone got hot and wouldn't do no more. Gun got cloud and started to rain. I tooted my horn for the passing lane. A rainwater blowing all under my hood. I knew that I was doing my motor good. Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started back doing the things you used to do. top of the hill. Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started back doing the thing you used to do.
Although it had long been audible on radio, both on records and on live broadcasts from churches, Negro gospel music had not, as yet, had much effect on popular music. But with the arrival of a new star, Sam Cooke, a former gospel singer, this was altered. The Negro rhythmic hymns, actually blues with sacred lyrics, joined the rock and roll stream. Sam Cooke's hit, You Send Me, brought into the sound of popular music the gospel feeling and the falsetto singing.
Darling, you send me. Honest you do, whoa, whoa. You thrill me. I know you thrill me. Darling, you thrill me. Honest you do. At first I thought it was infatuation, but ooh, it's lasted so. Wanting to marry you and take you home. Whoa.
Then the Kingston Trio brought folk music out into the open. A kind of collegiate do-it-yourself folk music group, the Kingston Trio may have lacked certain musical virtues, but it did open the way for the folk music boom that followed. After the Kingston Trio came Peter, Paul, and Mary singing If I Had a Hammer, a folk-type song written in the 1940s by Pete Seeger and Lee Hayes of the Weavers. It is interesting to note that the Weavers, a group of left-wing union activists and intellectuals devoted to the writing and singing of folk songs and songs of social significance, had been a sharp commercial success at the end of the 40s with several hit records. But the McCarthy era and the red-baiting which accompanied it resulted in a blacklisting of the Weavers, and they were barred from recording for several years. It is interesting to speculate on what might have happened had this not occurred. Had the Weavers continued to record for the popular record market during the early 50s, the whole of American popular music might have been altered earlier. Now, in versions by Peter, Paul, and Mary, and later by Trini Lopez, and still later by Johnny Rivers, If I Had a Hammer, a song whose lyric said something about integration and equality, became a teenage hit. The success of folk music, of Peter, Paul, and Mary, of the Kingston Trio, and also of a song called Walk Right In by the Rooftop Singers, it was a new version of a jug band tune written in the 20s by Gus Cannon, all of these things alerted the American entertainment industry to the existence of folk music. The Kingston Trio's Tom Dooley, however, was the song that really brought it out to the fore.
Throughout history, there have been many songs written about the Eternal Triangle. This next one tells the story of a Mr. Grayson, a beautiful woman, and a condemned man named Tom Dooley. When the sun rises tomorrow, Tom Dooley must hang.
Hang down your head, Tom Dooley, hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley, poor boy, you're bound to die. I met her on the mountain, there I took her life.
met her on the mountain, stabbed her with my knife.
Hang down your head, Tom, Julie, hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom, Julie, poor boy, you're bound to die.
This time tomorrow, reckon where I'll be. Hadn't it been for Grayson, I'd have been in Tennessee.
Well now, boy,
hang down your head,
Julie, hang down your head and cry.
Hang down your head, Julie, oh boy, you're bound to die.
Well now, boy,
hang down your head,
Julie,
hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head and try. Oh boy, you're bound to die.
This time tomorrow, reckon where I'll be. Down in some lonesome valley, hanging from a white oak tree.
Hang down your head, Tom, Dooley. Hang down your head and cry. Down your head, Tom, Dooley, poor boy, you're bound to die.
Oh well now, boy,
hang down your head, Tom, Dooley, hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom, Dooley, poor boy, you're bound to die. Poor boy, you're bound to die. Poor boy, you're bound to die.
Poor boy, you're bound to die.
Tom Dooley made the breakthrough. Since most folk music performers were white, or else old and supposedly safe Negroes, no color problem before it existed on TV, and the color problem was still a very real thing in television. This brought forth national TV shows devoted to folk music, paralleling the national TV shows aimed at teenagers with popular musical groups and singers, and featuring the new styles of dancing. The twist, the frug, the hully-gully, and the other inventions of the youth to go with the big beat of rock music. So at the end of the 50s and the beginning of the 60s, television, that great medium of entertainment, began to present parts of the popular music scene, but not all of it even yet. Muddy Waters, the blues singer from Mississippi, whose song Rolling Stone was the source for the Rolling Stones' name, and who, along with Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley, set the pattern for the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the other groups, appeared early this year at Stanford University in California. It was the first time he had been there, and it was the first time that any university in the western United States had seen him. At that point, he had yet to appear in a national TV show, and he told the audience as he stood on the stage, "I had to come to you behind the Rolling Stones and the Beatles." The statement is very true, and it implies a curious thing about American popular music. The strongest influence in American popular music, the contemporary Negro urban music, had to return to the United States in a cultural feedback from Britain, where Muddy Waters and Bo Diddley and Howlin' Wolf were well known long before they were known at all outside the Negro community in the United States. Another outstanding feature of American popular music a decade after the Korean War is the fact that many teenagers obviously want to hear songs that speak to them in images that are real and not in the images of the motion picture Dreamland World, Down in the Depths of the 90th Floor, or Fly Me to the Moon, the standard cliches of Broadway popular ballads. The new music of the Beatles, the Rolling Stone, and Bob Dylan fractured the stereotype of the American popular song in several ways. It abandoned the musical format of the 32-bar pop tune, and it also abandoned the pop tune song lyric rhetoric. One of the characteristics of the new music is the unusual nature of the melodic lines and the unorthodox and unusual chord changes, a refreshing departure from the rut popular music had been in for decades. In addition, these songs now actually do, in many instances, say things. The Drifters, for instance, who have had a dozen hits in the last 10 years, sing songs of alienation as well as songs of love. They sing of the rat race and of the necessity to gain the peace of isolation and the noise of the city. This last song is called Up on the Roof. Here is a group of American Negroes singing with a blues feeling, with a jazz beat, and with a gospel sound, a song that says, "Right smack dab in the middle of town, I found a paradise that's trouble-proof, up on the roof." One does not have to see The Cool World or read James Baldwin or Claude Brown to see the significance of this. Bob Dylan, the young Minnesota poet who ran away from home to become a sort of wandering minstrel of America, adopting some of Woody Guthrie and some of Negro singers, began to write songs of protest, including his classic, The Times They Are A-Changin'. Then his anti-discrimination song, Blowin' in the Wind, was made into a hit by Peter, Paul, and Mary, and thousands of American teenagers went to school humming or whistling or singing, How Many Roads Must a Man Walk Down Before You Call Him a Man?
How many roads must a man walk down before they call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? How many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many years must a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? How many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? How many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
The Beatles broke open the sound of popular music in America, and as Allen Ginsberg says, Bob Dylan put poetry on the jukebox. For generations, American popular music's fundamental inspiration had been the music of the Negroes. But by the time American popular music was ready for songs to say something, the Negroes' drive was towards middle-class acceptance, and conspicuous in the era since Korea was the absence of Negro folk singers. The old blues forms, with the lyrics of pure folk poetry, were good only for the aged rural Negroes to sing in their special historical roles at folk music festivals. What was really important was to get on the Ed Sullivan Show and to play the Copacabana. Not until very recently has there been any emphasis on content rather than on performance on the part of Negro artists. The new music of the Beatles, the new lyrics of Bob Dylan, have opened up the whole idea and concept of American popular music. Something can be said through music. Music can be communication of ideas as well as of feelings. American popular music today is a great seething, bubbling, thriving industry with hundreds of record companies and thousands of artists and the dream of every American teenager, as I suppose is the dream of teenagers throughout the world, is to become a rock and roll star and to hear his voice coming back to him from all the jukeboxes and radios of the world. It's a new dream and a great change from the dream of the motion picture era. It's a free market and practical demonstration. And the youthful record purchasers, the under 25 group, now more than 50% of the population of the United States, make a very discriminating audience. Some buy the records for the sound, or at least for the sound first and for the lyrics second. And it's demonstrably true that Americans buy popular records and make hits of them, even when the lyrics cannot be understood. At least three discs in the past few years have reached the top of the hit parade, which were in languages not understood by Americans. Volare, sung in Italian, Sukiyaki, sung in Japanese, and the Singing Nun record in French. Certainly records such as Dylan's Subterranean Homesick Blues are hard for adults to understand. Certainly some of the Rolling Stones records, 19th Nervous Breakdown is a good example, are hard even for the kids to understand at first. And as evidence of the importance, beneath it all, of understanding the lyrics, even though they may buy the disc for the sound, or the sound may make the initial impression, is the fact that record companies and disc jockeys printed up the lyrics of Dylan's Subterranean Homesick Blues and distributed them to thousands of record fans. You may see why.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement thinking about the government. Something you did.
but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway, looking for a new friend. A man in a green skin cap in a pig pen wants $11 bills. You only got 10. Maggie comes feet foot, face full of black soot, talking at your heat foot, plants in the bed, but phone's tapped anyway. Maggie says the medicine must bust an early man. Orders from the DA. Look out, kid, don't matter what you did. A walk on your tiptoes, don't tie no bows. Better stay away from those who care out of fire hose. Keep a clean nose, watch a clean clothes. You don't need a weatherman to know it. Well, hang around the ink well, hang bell, hard to tell if anything is gonna tell. Try hard, get boxed, get back, ride trail, get jailed, jump bail. Join the army if you fail. Look out, kid, you're gonna get hit by losers, cheaters, six-time users, hanging around the theater. Girl by the whirlpools, looking for a new fool. Don't follow leaders, or watch your parking meters. Get dressed, get flipped, tie a piece of success. Please her, please him, buy gifts, don't steal, don't live. 20 years of schooling and he put you on a day shift. Look out, kid, they keep it all hid. Better jump down a manhole, light yourself a candle. Don't wear sandals, try to forge a scandal. Don't want to be a bum, you better chew gum. The pump don't work, cause the vandal's just a handle.
American popular music is continually changing. Even the Beach Boys' concern with the amusements of California beach youths, surfing, drag racing, sports, and dating, seems to be in the process of shifting. Popular music is an immediate reflection of the attitudes and concerns of American life, and it is not without significance that American teenagers reflect many of the values of adult America. This could have been predicted by an alert sociologist in the mid-50s, when American youth first began to reject that medium of expression of American society closest to them, popular music. The new youth created its new and different popular music from all the various strains of music indigenous to the United States, even if some of them had to return here by way of Liverpool, like a sound wave bouncing off a U-boat in World War II. God may be dead, as the theologians are discussing, and the Beatles may really be more popular than Jesus. It remains a fact that in much of contemporary American popular music, there is a strong religious strain. Pete Seeger's adaptation of the verses from Ecclesiastes, Turn, 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 blared forth from radios and jukeboxes for months. Bob Dylan's songs show a deep moral thrust, and so do the efforts of Paul Simon. The latter's are almost church choir in a feeling at times, and are deeply concerned with man's moral dilemma. Late this fall, Simon and Garfunkel released a Columbia album on which they included, along with their hit Homeward Bound and several lovely ballads, a musical protest against the state of the nation. We have the obligation to say something. We can't remain silent, Paul Simon said in interviews. With this drive from the new youth, popular music in America is in a more healthy condition than ever before, morally as well as aesthetically. For the song which Simon referred to is his version of Silent Night, with a special message for the world this Christmas. It seems a proper note on which to end.
Into anti-Vietnam war protests. Demonstrators were forcibly evicted from the hearings. meetings where they began chanting anti-war slogans. Former Vice President Richard Nixon says that unless there is a substantial increase in the present war effort in Vietnam, the U.S. should look forward to 5 more years of war. In a speech before the Convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars in New York, Nixon also said opposition to the war in this country is the greatest single weapon working against the U.S. That's the 7 o'clock edition of the news. Good night.
That was The Birth of Pop by Ralph J. Gleason.